loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we'll talk about the increasing trade war between the United States and the People's Republic of China as Donald Trump's 25% tariffs on $34 billion of Chinese goods went into effect last night at 12:01 a.m., and China responded in kind. And then it's our regular Friday segment with the Lookman Nation, which covers the 2018 midterm election and other political updates.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, the remaining signatories to the Iran nuclear deal, or JCPOA, have agreed to stay in it with Iran and will resist the U.S. calls to sanction Iranian oil sales. However, Iran warned its fellow signatories that they would need to work on concrete solutions rather than on, quote, lofty and obscure promises, unquote. Next, in the face of international condemnation and on-the-ground resistance, an Israeli high court froze the planned demolition of the West Bank Palestinian village of Khan al-Ahmar late last night. We'll take a look at this struggle and the reality of life under the occupation. Then, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo arrived in Pyongyang this morning for talks with North Korean officials, his third trip in 3 months. Pompeo was greeted by top-ranking DPRK officials and is expected to push denuclearization talks forward, and the White House has laid out three scenarios for success, one in 6 months, one in a year, and one by the end of President Trump's term. And then, do kids have the right to a decent education? A U.S. District Court judge in Michigan ruled that they do not. In response to a class-action lawsuit alleging that underfunding and racism in Detroit schools have done tremendous harm to the city's children. And finally, we'll look at this week's worst and most misleading headlines. And in other headlines, the Social Democratic Party of Germany, the main coalition partner for Chancellor Angela Merkel, announced that it would support her controversial plan on refugees seeking asylum in Europe. The crisis in the German coalition began when the Christian Social Union, Merkel's Bavarian ally, gave an ultimatum to the chancellor to devise a new hardline immigration policy. Critics accused the German coalition of pandering to the far right in the face of the growth of the Alternative for Germany party. The Department of Labor's jobs report was released today, indicating that the economy added 213,000 jobs in June. This is a slight decline from the employment figures in May, when 244,000 jobs were added. The official unemployment rate, the U3 number, stood at 4%, but the labor force participation rate remains at historic lows. Former Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif was sentenced to 10 years in prison on corruption charges. Sharif, who was in office until last July, is now living in London, and it's unclear when or if he'll return to Pakistan. The court ruling comes ahead of the country's general election later this month, in which Sharif's Pakistan Muslim League is expected to do well. A partial agreement was reached in southern Syria between rebels and forces supporting the Syrian government. Under the deal brokered by Russia, rebels will surrender a key border crossing along with heavy weapons in return for a government withdrawal from several villages. The battle for control of the south has led to a major refugee crisis. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
But first, we turn to the trade war that the United States has launched. The United States launched what appears to be the largest trade war perhaps ever last night when it imposed a 25% tariff on $34 billion in Chinese goods. Beijing announced that it will respond in kind, and economists warn that the only outcome is that the U.S. consumers will pay more for everything that comes from that country. We're joined from London by Jude Woodward. She is the author of the new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. And we're joined from London by Steve Keen, the author of Debunking Economics and the World's First Crowdfunded Economist. You can check out his work at patreon.com/Prof. Steve Keen. It's Keen is K-E-E-N. Jude and Steve, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Good to be here.
Hi there.
Jude Woodward, let's start with you. You know, not a surprise that this is happening, but nonetheless, it's a big, big event. Let's just get your big picture takeaway right now.
Well, it's a very serious development. It's bad for the U.S., it's bad for China, it's bad for the world. it's hard to see how Trump can roll back from this, because he's just escalating his threats and seems to have made the red lines for a US retreat from a trade war with China, a whole series of demands which China can't and won't meet, and that has been clear from the start. And as I've said on this program on previous occasions, China offered a very reasonable compromise. It said, okay, you're worried about the trade deficit. We will deal with the trade deficit by buying a lot more American goods, primarily agricultural products and foods, but also cars. And that seemed a very positive way to deal with the problem, because it would have actually boosted trade overall. What's clear is that the US isn't really concerned about the trade deficit. That's just convenient rhetoric. The real issue is it wants to stop China catching up technologically, and it believes this is the only way it can.
Steve Keen, your take.
My perspective is always, my starting perspective is that globalization as a strategy for the planet was always a fallacy, because it ignores the fact that growth comes from, not from allocating existing resources better, but by creating resources better. And that's what China has done with its specialization on industrialization and manufacturing. And America effectively has gone backwards, and it's been the working class of America who suffered in this process. They've gone from being the industrial workers of the world to the service sector and welfare workers of the world. And so that's what has led to this, the anger that Trump has tapped to turn these tariffs on. And equally, countries which have industrialized successfully have normally done behind protectionist barriers, which China itself has done. So Trump has a point in his attack on China. The trouble is that the way Trump is doing this is completely disruptive. It's not going to generate further industrial growth for America, first of all. What it'll do is disrupt their supply chains, and it'll ultimately force some investment by American industry. But I think they've lost so much ground to China that China's more likely to say, right, we'll turn away from China, from American trade, and go towards building the Silk Road and have our trade with Europe and the countries on the way to Europe. And that's what seem to be some of the overtures that China's been making to Europe quite recently. So I think this is a sign of a decline of an empire, where the empire has actually eaten itself, and that empire, of course, is America.
Jude Woodward, we're not in the Midwest. We're not in the sort of industrial states. We're here in Washington, D.C. So it's a little bit hard to know what the mood in the country is. But I have to say that based on media reports, there's quite a number of working class people in the Midwest, even in agricultural areas that are being harmed by the trade war, who still seem to think that Donald Trump is doing something good for America. He's standing up for the Americans. And we also, in other words, it may not be politically disastrous, even though it's hurting some business interests in those areas. Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue said last month at a Chicago convention that the Commodity Credit Corporation, that's CCC, is a tool that he's considering to comply with Trump's instructions to craft a strategy to support our farmers against retaliatory tariffs. The program, which was started to help farmers during the Great Depression, allows the Agriculture Department to borrow as much as $30 billion from the U.S. Treasury that could be used then to buy crops from farmers that would go unsold in a trade war. Again, it's obvious that Trump is actually carrying out what amounts to a political strategy on the home front, in addition to your suggestion in the beginning that what the U.S. really wants to do is stop China's rise. But there is a very strong political component to this. Anyway, that's my take. Go ahead.
Well, I think there's some truth in that, but I think that people are completely unrealistic. I mean, there was an interview with a soybean farmer on the British TV, an American soybean farmer, who was very much in favour of this trade war, but thought that it should be over by the time of the soybean harvest in September. And this is just completely unrealistic. The idea that this will be a short, sharp, bash China, China will then give in, America will be great again, and by September he'll be able to sell his soybeans at the previous price into the previous market, i.e. China. This is completely unrealistic. So the political work, so it reminds me somewhat of the attitudes to Brexit here, where people have completely unrealistic notions about what this will all mean. And it will only become clear when it actually happens what it actually means. And I think that a lot of supporters of Trump's trade war have completely unrealistic ideas about what it all will all mean.
What I'm wondering about, though, is whether the U.S. government, with this, you know, vast capacity for limitless funds in some areas, and of course the advantage of being the world currency, the dollar, which the U.S. government has the opportunity to print, unlike all other countries, whether the Trump administration plans to really cushion, or can it cushion, either agricultural interests or some industrial enterprises that depend, for instance, on the use of steel and aluminum, the price of which will go up now, to cushion them so that it's not that big of a deal in the short term. What do you think about that as a prospect?
Well, I think it has the resources to do that in the short term. It has the resources to do almost anything in the short term, but it's not a sustainable situation because of the US is already tremendously overspent. And part of this whole trade war, make America great again problem is that US productivity is declining comparatively to its main competitors internationally. And that is being reflected in big trade deficits with China and Germany in particular. And Trump is trying to, one, prevent China to reverse that, but and to prevent China becoming a more powerful economy than the US. And with Germany making threats in order to try to get Germany to reduce its trade deficit with the US, i.e. to subsidize the US and to support the US in its trade war with China. So this is, but the underlying problem is declining US competitivity in comparison to its main competitors, and that a subsidy for soybean farmers will make that worse, not better.
Yeah, I'm looking at the Global Times, which is not the organ of the Chinese Communist Party or any official organ, but it's largely seen as reflecting the views of the Chinese Communist Party. The headline from right now of their editorial is U.S. trade hegemony is doomed to fail. The first sentence or two, on July 6th, the U.S. kickstarted a trade war by imposing an additional 25% in tariffs on $34 billion worth of Chinese products, triggering an immediate retaliation from China. U.S. President Donald Trump also threatened to impose tariffs on another $500 billion in Chinese products, pushing threats to the extreme. However, this will not likely to stop China from fighting back. The U.S. move will give it a permanent, infamous record in international trade. Washington violated the rules of the World Trade Organization by starting a trade war, which will damage the global economy beyond Washington's wildest imaginations. It is fair to say that the U.S. has become a, quote, sinner, close quote, of world trade. The Chinese are angry, no doubt about that.
May I add something to that too? You know, how interesting is it that from the very beginning of this issue, it's the Chinese who have been the voices of reason. It's the Americans who have been the ones flouting the rules, ignoring the World Trade Organization. And then you have to turn to an outlet that is, if not the official outlet of the Chinese Communist Party, essentially speaks on its behalf for reason. I'm hard pressed to think of another example like this, at least in my adult lifetime, where it comes to trade, where it's the Chinese that are the reasonable ones taking the international lead here, and the Americans on the brink of crashing the world economy.
Yeah, it's one of the ironies, Jude. A government led by the Communist Party is actually insisting that the United States government play by the rules of the World Trade Organization, the organization, the instrument designed to regulate trade within the confines of and in the context of the global economy, which is clearly a global capitalist economy. I mean, it is an irony of history.
It's an irony of history, but on the other hand, the International Division of Labour would demand that you had rules governing trade, even if everyone was communist. So I don't find it surprising that the Chinese want to insist that there should be international rules and regulations that govern how this is conducted. The ones on offer are ones made in the capitalist world, and I'm sure the ones that were made by a communist world would be somewhat different, but there would have to be rules.
Yeah. One of the things that's really driving this too, John, is the ascendancy of Peter Navarro.
Absolutely. Peter made an important point yesterday. Go ahead and tell
Peter
people.
Peter Navarro is the China expert
right. In
the Trump administration, except he's not an expert on China. I mean, there's that little problem.
Well, but he speaks Chinese, doesn't he?
No, he doesn't speak Chinese, right. Doesn't speak Mandarin, doesn't speak Cantonese, has hardly ever gone to China. He was a guy who was a local politician in San Diego. He mm-hmm. ran for office five times, and guess what? He lost five times. People so hated him in San Diego right now when the media interviews them, they can't believe that Peter Navarro is like dictating world trade terms with Donald Trump. So he reinvented himself because his star was not shining ever, but even at its low, dull brightness, it was still in decline. So some of his students, he realized, were losing their jobs in 2005, and they said it was because Chinese people were taking their jobs. So he got interested in China. That was in 2005. Now he's written books called Death by China, The Coming China Wars, Crouching Tiger. I mean, Donald Trump found out about Peter Navarro because the Coming China Wars was also turned into this anti-China documentary, and Donald Trump happened to watch it in 2015. And he was like, oh, I like that. That's we're going to have a war with China. Anyway, Jude Woodward, when you really put all of this together, you have Donald Trump, a mid-level real estate guy who was basically bankrupt, except Deutsche Bank, bailed him out. And by the way, Justice Kennedy, Anthony Kennedy, who resigned in time so Trump could rename and put a permanent sort of stamp on the Supreme Court. His son, Justin, is also a high official at the Deutsche Bank, which, again, Donald Trump got a lot of money, saved Donald Trump. And then you have Peter Navarro, this guy who's not a China expert, doesn't speak Chinese, but writes books about the coming China wars. I mean, it's really something in terms of American governance, Jude, that this government is led by these people.
Well, I have to say Peter Navarro is the one that made me laugh, because I came across Peter Navarro long before Trump was elected, and I read his book, The Coming China Wars, and it is ludicrous. I was literally laughing all the way through and was quite shocked to discover it was published by the Financial Times, because it was like a comic book full of complete rubbish and evident rubbish. And I thought, okay, so this guy's a nutter. But then he turns up in this senior post in the Trump administration. You thought, well, this is completely crazy. The guy he's got wrong positions on trade, but he's completely paranoid about China. Yeah, so you have a situation where Trump, there is a coterie of people around Trump, and it's not just Navarro, but there is a coterie of people in the Trump administration, and it goes beyond the immediate administration. You think that a go-it-alone, beg-your-neighbor protectionist policy will reap benefits for the United States, and that the only way to prevent China overtaking the US, and in the future is to try to bring it to heel using this trade war as the weapon. This is strongly held view by a very considerable section of what is now the administration of the United States. The problem is, as others, as you said, and as the Global Times said, this is going to be damaging for the United States and damaging for the world.
Steve Keen is back with us. Steve Keen, thank you for rejoining. I know you're in transit at the moment. I want to go. We were just talking about Peter Navarro, the China expert, who's not an expert on China, being such a driver, along with Trump, who also knows so little about world economy or China, driving this policy. But I want to go back to a question I started to ask you right when we lost you. And I also asked Jude Woodward the same question, and she responded. But I want to get your take also as an economist. We're highlighting the fact that Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue has said that the Trump administration will use the Commodity Credit Corporation as a tool and borrow up to $30 billion to shield or American agricultural interest. In other words, to buy crops that would otherwise go unsold because of the absence of a China market. And what I was asking both of you is, does the U.S. government have the capacity, the resources to actually provide a shield or a cushion, and not just in the short term, but for the long term, for these different interests who may be right now politically with Trump, right now voting Republican, but who might not otherwise if they're harmed? Does the U.S. government have that capacity?
Yes, it does. And this is the ironic thing about the behavior of countries about thus far in trade negotiations and everything else. They pretend they can run out of their own money. Now, of course, the Europeans can run out of money because they don't produce their own money. They've got the European Central Bank throttling their economies with control over the euro. But the American government can create as much money as it wants for whatever purpose it wants. And, of course, being the reserve currency of the planet doesn't face the consequences of running a trade deficit in the sense of facing devaluation, because people still need the American dollar for their own international transactions. So there is no limit to the capacity of a sovereign government to create its own money. And the case of the US is a sovereign government whose money is used as international currency. So they can do this relatively indefinitely. And Alan Greenspan's actually said that to Congress when he was challenged on this point by Paul Ryan some years ago. I don't often find myself agreeing with Alan Greenspan, but at that point he was quite right. So the capacity is there for America to continue doing this. It's only their paranoia about their own level of national debt that stops them doing it. So Trump does have a weapon he can use indefinitely to compensate on a grand scale if necessary, sectors that might lose out by China imposing retaliatory tariffs.
Yeah, and I don't think Trump is caring that much about the debt or the national deficit, because he just increased it by $1.5 trillion.
And never even raised it
in a
speech or as an issue.
So that's not a thing right now, Steve, at least not for the Republicans, it doesn't seem like. Even though when the Democrats are trying to pass even the smallest, measliest little social program that would benefit working people, they cry about the deficit, demand that it not happen because of the deficit. They actually don't care about the deficit. That's not a thing for them.
Yeah, I think that's true. It's a sort of background belief they've all got, which is a fallacy, but they'll go back to it whenever they're threatened. If they're in control, they seem to ignore the fallacy and just push on. Of course, you know, Reagan was, most people from my side of economic theory regard Reagan as one of the greatest Keynesian presidents of all time, because imposing the nonsense of the Laffer curve, believing cutting taxes would increase revenue. Of course, it increased the deficit, but that gave a major stimulus to the American economy at the time. And then effectively, Trump is doing the same thing right now with his massive tax cuts. They're going to the wrong people, but they're still boosting government spending compared to government taxation, pumping more money into the economy than they're pumping out. And that's part of why the economy is in a boom right now.
That's the voice of Steve Keen. He's the author of Debunking Economics and the World's First Crowdfunded Economist. You can check out his work at patreon.com/ProfSteveKeen. We're also talking from London with Jude Woodward. She is the author of a new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. Jude, I want to talk to you about your title there, because, of course, there is a new Cold War of sorts with Russia. The national security strategy that was adopted in January, and Trump personally came out to announce it, unlike other presidents in the past who don't usually do it. It's a quadrennial report. That report identified China and Russia as the principal threats to the United States and made it clear that the United States, the Pentagon, was gearing up both in contingency planning and budgeting for what they called in the report major power confrontation in the coming years or decades. Is it a Cold War? Is it possible that we can go beyond a Cold War? What's your evaluation on that?
I think it's extremely unlikely, but of course, Trump is an extremely unpredictable person. It's extremely unlikely that given that China is also a nuclear armed state, even though it is on nothing like the level of military development of the United States, it would be such a hugely destructive business for China and the US to confront each other militarily that I don't believe. China has made it clear it's not, that there's no question of it pursuing such a course and it has no interest in it. But I find it hard to believe any US president, including Trump, would not face huge opposition from within the Pentagon and elsewhere if he tried to turn a Cold War into a hot war with China. Now, that doesn't rule out regionalized small conflicts that could blow up. And certainly something China is quite worried about is the spreading of the Middle East type situation to countries close to China so that you get terrible destabilized states around China's borders. That was part of its concern regarding North Korea and the threats that were made towards North Korea. But a major all-out confrontation, I think that's extremely unlikely.
That's the voice of Jude Woodward. We're talking to her from London, and we're also talking to Steve Keen. Steve, we have about 2 minutes left. I was reading some Western media accounts of Chinese public opinion in reaction to some of this, including Trump's decision to, which he's partly sort of taken back, but it had a huge impact on thinking in China, basically barring the huge corporation ZTE from being able to buy anything from the United States. And they relied as a technology company on American producers to supply some of the more advanced chips. This has become sort of the Sputnik moment for China, at least in the fields of high technology. The Sputnik moment, meaning when the United States realized that the Soviet Union was actually ahead of it in terms of the space race and perhaps parts of the military, advanced military arms race, or at least it was, you know, taken in that way. And that led to this major ramping up in the United States of a technological spurt designed to compete with the Soviet Union. Will it have that kind of political outcome? We have about 90 seconds left.
I don't think it will. The major reason is that China has been extremely successful in building the supply chains and the management systems you need for integrated, for circuit, things that depend upon integrated circuits, but they haven't actually built anything like the technology that Intel has or AMD to produce those integrated circuits themselves. And we're talking multi-billion dollar factories these days, sub-micron manufacturing levels. You simply can't get up very, very rapidly. So the one of the Trump cards that Trump has is Intel. And the fact that all the processors and all the computers in the world rely upon Intel or AMD fundamentally for its central processing units. That's not the sort of thing you can ramp up anywhere near as rapidly as China's ramped up the rest of its manufacturing. So I think that gives them a lever over China. But China will certainly dedicate itself to trying to do that. And I think we could see them trying to probably achieve that in the next 5 to 10 years. Give them 5 or 10 years, they could probably pull it off.
All right. We're going to leave it right there. That was Steve Keen. He's the author of Debunking Economics, the world's first crowdfunded economist. You can check out his work at patreon.com/Prof. Steve Keen. And we've been joined also from London by Jude Woodward. She's the author of the new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. Again today, we take a look at political races around the country in the run-up to the midterm elections in November. This week, we saw developments all around America. More and more races are tightening up. We knew this would happen. We predicted that it would happen. And it's happening all over the country. Jackie, when we are preparing for this segment during the course of the week, we both begin to accumulate articles that we find, whether it's The Post or The Times or Politico or The Hill or whatever. There are too many to go over in 30 minutes. There's so much happening.
Yeah.
Where would you like to start?
I, first of all, would like to start with expressing my sadness at the death of Ed Schultz.
Oh, I said the same thing yesterday on Facebook.
You know,
wonderful man.
You know, here's a guy who I respected a lot as a journalist, who was brave enough to stand up against the DNC shadiness,
and paid for it with his job,
and that's why he lost his very popular show on MSNBC, ended up going to RT. Still the same guy, still the same quality political journalism, and his sudden passing was such a loss for as a fan and as a political junkie like myself. It was just really a shock.
I was on his show about a week ago, and I've been on periodically over the time that he's been at RT, and he looked terrific. He looked healthy. He looked happy. He looked energetic. I guess you just never know. It's a big loss for all of us.
It's a huge loss. And then I'm also sad, but because I know what's coming at the resignation of Scott Pruitt. Now,
right.
Liberals and progressives, we need to stop being so reactionary about every single thing, because people are celebrating Scott Pruitt's resignation.
It's not going to get any better.
It's not going to get any better because the person who, I cannot remember the guy's name, but the person who might succeed him is actually even worse.
Yes.
He is a coal lobbyist.
Yes.
So
that was reported in today's Washington Post. He's a coal lobbyist.
Yes.
And he's going to be in charge of regulating the coal industry.
Yes.
Yeah, this isn't going to be good.
Just ridiculous. As far as the midterm, the run-up to the midterm races, the primaries, Justice Kennedy's sudden resignation all of a sudden plays an enormous factor in the upcoming midterm races, because in five states, and this is reported by Politico, I think, in five states, who the candidates support, whether they will support Trump's nominee to replace Kennedy, could decide their campaigns.
You know, so much of the press focus is on Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Susan Collins of Maine, two moderate Republican female senators. And I think that that's actually wrong. First of all, Susan Collins, through her entire career, has, at the end of the day, supported the president of her own party.
Right.
She makes a lot of noise about standing up and being independent and moderate. And she's not.
Right.
It's all talk.
Right.
I think that if the Democrats hope to block whomever ends up being appointed, and it's probably premature to even talk about blocking anybody if we don't know who the nominee is going to be.
Right.
I think they're going to have to look at the likes of Rand Paul or even Mike Lee of Utah, and maybe attack whoever the nominee is from a libertarian perspective.
I think that's really a very interesting perspective to take. It's interesting that that's the reality the Democrats are in. And primarily, I think it's because they were so weak in appointing their own Supreme Court. They put themselves in a position to not have a leg to stand on in this fight.
Right.
That this is a life or death kind of situation. And for many of these Democratic candidates, whether they survive their primary challenges or not depends on whether they support Trump's pick or not. It didn't have to be that way if they fought for the Supreme Court nominee under Obama. But they did not fight for it.
No.
And now they are paying for it in states like North Dakota,
mm-hmm.
where Trump won by 36 points.
It's crazy.
36 points. And Heitkamp, who is one of Trump's Democratic favorites.
Yeah. In fact, he's invited Heidi Heitkamp onto Air Force One with him a number of times.
Yeah.
She's gone to Mar-a-Lago. She's gone overseas with him.
She's made it very plain and very clear that, she doesn't have a problem supporting Trump.
Right.
But he actually came out and campaigned so much for you know, showing your voters that, you support Trump. He came out and said to attendees of a rally where he campaigned for, who is it, Kevin Cramer?
Kevin Cramer.
Who is her Republican challenger,
right,
that you don't need a candidate who talks like they support my policies. You need a candidate who votes like you support my policies. So her support of him just went right out the window.
Kevin Cramer has complained through this entire campaign that Donald Trump is supposed to be on his side, right? He's a Republican. Trump is a Republican. He's campaigning to defeat Heidi Heitkamp and to flip that seat to the Republicans. And then it's like Trump is having this love affair with Heidi Heitkamp, and Heitkamp is perfectly happy to vote Republican when the chips are down. And that's why she's going to win, most likely, in a state that, as you pointed out, Donald Trump carried by 36 percentage points.
Exactly. So, you know, I think in North Dakota, all of this is kind of theater, but it's very interesting theater.
I agree. I'm going to give you a little bit of trivia, too, that almost nobody knows. One of my best friends in college complimented me on this one time. He said that I knew more about politics than anybody he had ever met, because I knew that the last four senators from North Dakota had previously been the state insurance commissioner.
Oh, wow.
That is the stepping off point if you want to be in the United States Senate in North Dakota.
The insurance commissioner?
In Texas, it's the railroad commissioner.
Get out of here. Mm-hmm. Well, that makes sense in Texas. That actually, historically, that makes perfectly good sense.
And that's why it's either railroad or it can be agriculture commissioner in Texas. And that's why George P. Bush, the son of Jeb Bush, is the agriculture commissioner of Texas right now.
Wow.
Because the plan is eventually for him to run for the Senate or to run for governor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's that is great trivia.
Hey, speaking of trivia, too, I wanted to, this is not an important issue, and we ought not spend more than a minute or so on it, but it was so much fun. We've talked in the past about this actual bona fide Nazi who's running for Congress from Illinois. He actually was insulted when a journalist referred to him as a neo-Nazi, and he protested saying, I'm not a neo-Nazi, I'm a Nazi.
I'm an actual Nazi.
He won the Republican nomination for this congressional seat, and now there's a split between the Republican governor of Illinois, Bruce Rauner, and, of all people, Ted Cruz. So Ted Cruz, this is total role reversal here. Ted Cruz called on Republicans in this district to vote for the Democrat.
What?
Right. Bruce Rauner called for Republicans to not vote for the Democrat, to just demand that the Nazi drop out. So this has created something of a kerfuffle among Republicans in Illinois.
But you know what? What do we say every week when we talk about some whack job GOP candidate that they that they've allowed in? This is what happens when you don't take a stand against these people with very problematic, and that's saying the least, ideologies aligning themselves with your party. You can't get to this point in state and national elections knowing that you have these factions in your party and you let them in because you wanted to win, and now you can't control them.
That's right. And they went through this. The Republicans went through this in the 80s with David Duke.
Yes, they did.
And
yes,
they created a monster that they couldn't control.
Exactly. So I honestly have no sympathy for them. It's enjoyable to watch because, again, it is watching the implosion of a political party that's really suffering from its own lack of morals.
Yes.
In so many ways.
Yes.
Is he going to win anything? Of course not. But just the fact that he won his primary, beyond that, he's not going to advance any further. But just the fact that people are just fine voting for someone who said, I'm a Nazi.
Well, you know, somebody said on MSNBC the other day that, well, this guy's only going to get 10 or 12%. And I thought, my God, 10 or 12%? Mm-hmm. That's a lot of people. Voting for an actual Nazi.
Convert that 10 or 12%. And this is the mistake that I think a lot of pundits make when they talk about politics and polls. They stick to only percentage points.
Yes.
They don't convert those percentage points into people.
Yes.
And those people's stories. So, okay, 10 to 12 percentage points in politics sometimes is not that big of a deal. But when you're talking about actual people behind those numbers, no, that's very frightening, especially for people of color.
Yep. Yep. I think you're exactly right. Hey, last week we talked about the Democratic leadership of the House of Representatives and how old they were. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't mean to be unkind, but we're talking about Nancy Pelosi and Steny
right.
Hoyer
mm-hmm.
and Jim Clyburn. And they're like 80, 78 and 78. Or 79, 78, and 78. Well, this past week, Steny Hoyer was hospitalized
right.
with pneumonia. He continues to be hospitalized.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when a 78-year-old man gets pneumonia and can't work his way out of the hospital,
right.
there's a problem.
Yes.
Well, this guy is supposed to be the number two among Democrats in the House of Representatives. Now, the party at this very moment is also having a debate about replacing the likes of Steny Hoyer and Jim Clyburn and Nancy Pelosi with people perhaps two generations younger. We saw this mm-hmm. Race in Queens the other day.
Yes.
What do you make of this? And is this a harbinger of things to come? Is Steny Hoyer going to have to step aside for health reasons perhaps?
That I can't call, but I do believe that they all should. I do believe that they all should cede their positions to the younger generation, but that's not going to happen. And here's why. This is the problem the Democratic Party is facing. Democrats who claim to be progressive, because progressivism is making a much needed resurgence in this country right now. People are beginning to understand what progressivism is, that it is policies that give us progress towards social and economic equality. That's what, just at the highest level understanding, that is what progressivism is. That's what people want. Policies that put more money in their paychecks, make society more equal, make society more just and fair. Simple. The problem is the Democrats do not really want to support younger or any candidates who espouse those policies.
Yeah, that's been a problem for a long time for the Democrats.
That has been a decades-long problem since the Democratic Leadership Council, when it was the DLC's strategy.
That's right.
To
the 1992
step away from
elections.
Absolutely, to step away from progressive policies. So now that the Democrats have made lots and lots of money, and have gained lots and lots of power and influence from not being progressives, now they want to claim that they're progressives.
Right.
But actual progressives are looking at them and saying, no, you're not.
Oh, no, you don't.
No, you're not. And that's the fight that's going on in the Democratic Party, which is why these people who need to cede the party leadership over to the younger generation, because they have the energy, they have the ideas, and many of them do have the interests of the actual people and not corporations
mm-hmm.
at heart, that this is why they're not going to cede power to these people.
Yeah.
And that is a serious problem for the Democratic Party. This is the Democratic Party's point of implosion that we're watching.
Yes.
That the Democratic Party is collapsing from the inside because of its own infighting over what are supposed to be its progressive bona fides, and they don't want to actually claim them.
Mm-hmm.
Then you've got people on the inside like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez,
that's right.
who is a Democratic Socialist of America candidate but ran as a Democrat, who is bringing these policies to the party. And the
yes.
party is making clear that they don't want.
That's right. That's right.
So.
But when you're winning races against 20-year incumbents with 54% of the vote.
Right.
The leadership has to take you seriously.
And it's unfortunate that the leadership isn't. When you have Nancy Pelosi coming out and saying, well, just because this one errant victory happened in Queens, the Democratic mm-hmm. Party isn't going mm-hmm. socialist. Socialism isn't the question here. We're
no.
talking about progressive policies
That's right.
that help the people. And as long as the Democrats continue to stick to that tone deaf message and ignore the needs of the people, they're going to continue to not have a leg to stand on against the onslaught of the GOP, no matter how morally bankrupt they are.
Let's talk about some of these Senate races. We tend to repeat ourselves because there really are only about five or six races that are truly close. Mm-hmm. Well, this past week, Politico had a nice article. They took a slightly different tack. They called it, "These five Senate races will be pivotal battlegrounds in the coming Supreme Court clash."
Right.
So most of them are the same races that we talk about. But there were a couple of surprises for me. Now, the number one was Indiana.
Yeah.
Joe Donnelly's in big trouble in Indiana.
Yeah.
The Republicans are generally unified there. It's a Republican state. In a fluke, it went for Obama in 2008. It went for Romney in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Donnelly tends to vote Republican because he's trying to save himself.
Right.
It remains to be seen if that's enough. Trump won the state by 19 percentage points.
Right.
North Dakota, we talked about a few minutes ago, 36 mm-hmm. percentage points. Heidi Heitkamp, I think, is going to pull that race out.
Yeah.
She's been consistently underestimated as a campaigner.
That's true.
And she's not progressive.
No, she is not progressive.
She's actually a pretty good fit for that state. And she's the former insurance commissioner.
That's important.
But the next state that Politico focused on was a surprise for me, and that was Arizona.
Arizona. Yeah.
There's a real shot for the Democrats to pick up Arizona because both Jeff Flake, whose seat it is, and John McCain have been so willing to challenge this president. What does Arizona look like to you?
I think Arizona is one of those states where Democrats could pick this seat up because the Republican challengers, one of them is just a repulsive human being.
Right.
And even Republicans don't want him around, and
correct,
that's Joe Arpaio.
In fact, Joe Arpaio is only polling about 24%.
Right.
Nobody likes him.
Nobody likes him, but that's enough to dilute the vote for the Republican challenger.
Indeed.
Against a very popular Democratic candidate.
That's right.
Who is polling double digits over all three Republican candidates. So even if, and apparently one of the Republican challengers, I can't remember her, McSally.
Martha McSally
is already using.
Moderate Republican
Congresswoman. Moderate Republican already has campaign ads out there trying to attack the Democratic candidate for, she believes she's going to vote against Trump's Supreme Court pick. Right. So
right.
So the Supreme Court nominee that Trump is going to announce, I think, next week.
Sometime next week, early next week.
Yeah. There
Monday
are Republicans
Tuesday.
Who are already using that to attack their Democratic challengers. And Arizona is one of those states. I don't think that's going to matter in Arizona, though. I think because this Democratic candidate, Representative Kristen Sinema, I hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly. She is polling well, like I said,
she's up by 12 percentage points right now, which is dramatic for a Democrat in a state like Arizona.
Yeah, over all three Republican candidates. Mm-hmm. McSally is already behind.
Mm-hmm. Which is funny because you would think that with all the retirees there, that they would be drawn, they would be attracted to a moderate Republican woman. And they don't appear to be.
They don't appear to be. And I think there are so many factors at play right there. I haven't had a chance to really think about what all is going into that. But I think the potential challenge to Roe versus Wade, the willingness of Republicans to appoint activist judges now when, 7-8 years ago, there was this big backlash of among the GOP of the activist judges. They claimed that Obama was going to appoint.
Right.
I mean, you know, so that then that's Arizona is a really, really interesting place. I do think the fact that Trump pardoned Arpaio and Arpaio is now legitimately running again in the political arena, I think that rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. A lot of Republicans the
it
wrong
did.
Way. I think they're
I think
making
so
the
too.
Party pay for that.
I think so, too.
I think Arizona is one of those places where because of people like Arpaio running, I think Democrats are a little bit more energized.
I think so, too.
In that state. So
I think
it's
so
all of that stuff.
And more unified.
Yeah.
The next state is Missouri. There's been so much going on in Missouri. I actually was talking to a Republican campaign official in this race just a few days ago, And she was telling me that the president has actually blown this race. That,
really?
Yeah, that the Republican attorney general was sort of the pretty boy candidate. He was the candidate of the party structure. He was imposed on the voters of Missouri as this is the guy you're supposed to vote for. Uh-huh. In fact, there's an insurgent, a former Navy SEAL, who's far more conservative and is a better campaigner. But the White House has pushed all that Republican money away from his campaign and toward the attorney general.
Hmm.
So now you have what may be a very divisive Republican primary in Missouri that nobody was expecting to take place.
And this is, again, how many times have we talked about how Claire McCaskill
has
been
nine
lucky?
Lives.
She's just been lucky.
Yeah, she every 6 years, the Republicans blow it in their race against her.
And they're doing it again, it appears. So this is another one of those races where McCaskill, who has voted for other Trump nominees, so it wouldn't be unconscionable that she would vote for his Supreme Court nominee, even though she is
sure,
said, no, I'm not going to say anything about it so far. If the Republicans are going to stumble toward the finish line like they always do, it doesn't matter what she does.
No,
it doesn't matter what she does.
It's not going to matter, especially if the Republicans end up with enough votes for this nominee anyway. Especially if the Republicans have enough votes for this nominee, a Democrat can vote no and might not have to pay a price that otherwise would have been higher.
Right.
And then the final state that Politico believes is important for the Supreme Court nominee is West Virginia.
Yeah.
We've talked about Joe Manchin a million times
mm-hmm.
on this show.
Mm-hmm.
I think Joe Manchin's going to win re-election. He was a popular two-term governor. He won big 6 years ago for this Senate seat. He's a conservative Democrat, probably the most conservative Democrat in the Senate. And it's hard for Trump to attack him.
I don't think it matters if Manchin votes one way or the other on Trump's pick. I think his challenger, the Republican challengers in every other state, are hoping they can use the potential Democratic votes against Trump's pick, who, they don't even know who it is yet, but they're planning on being able to use this as a tactic, a campaign tactic against these Democrats. But in Manchin's case, I don't think it matters. I really don't, because he's been a pretty staunch Democratic supporter of
yeah.
Trump. He actually said he might even endorse him for president in 2020. So
yeah, that's happened in the past a couple of times, and it's really unbecoming.
It is extremely unbecoming, which is, again, the problem with the Democratic Party. If we can't distinguish you and your policies from the GOP, why should we continue to vote for these either one of the parties? Why
yep.
shouldn't we
yep.
choose someone else?
I agree. And that really also argues for a third party. I know
Absolutely.
I'm stretching things a little bit, but it really does argue for a third party. If you're a member of a party and you dislike your own nominee enough that you're mm-hmm. going to endorse the other party's nominee,
right.
then we need more than two parties.
Absolutely. And this entire examination of the run-up to the midterms and the primaries and what's going on and in national politics and how it all connects, it all just continues to underscore the need that we have in this country for true political representation from more people than just those folks who identify as Democrat or Republican.
Mm-hmm.
Because as W.E.B. Du Bois said, they're just two wings of the same evil bird.
The last race I want to talk about, we have 3 minutes left in this segment, is a race we really haven't spent much time on in the past, and that is the Montana Senate race.
Oh,
John
yeah.
Tester
mm-hmm.
is the incumbent senator. He's a Democrat, a moderate, but he and Donald Trump just simply do not like each other.
No, they do not.
And they attack each other all the time. Well, as it happens, Donald Trump was in Montana yesterday. And he went after John Tester like nobody's business, calling him a liberal Democrat, calling him names, and then for whatever reason, making fun of Elizabeth Warren in the same breath
yes.
and then mocking the Me Too movement.
Yeah.
At the same time, Tester saw this coming. And so throughout all of Trump's trip to Montana, he's been running positive advertisements touting his own accomplishments in the Senate. I haven't seen a poll in this race in several weeks, but the last poll that I saw showed Tester running very strongly. The Hill newspaper here says that Trump won Montana by 20 percentage points. The most recent poll from early June, which is quite dated, shows Tester with an 8-point lead. Still, you know, anything can happen between July 4th and Election Day, especially when there's only a difference of 8 points. This could certainly change.
It might change. Trump is appealing to people who he knows will respond to the kind of I mean, I think we in the political arena need to stop being shocked that Trump goes on the campaign trail and says the juvenile and hateful things that he does about people, because he knows that works. It's marketing.
He's better at riling up his base than any president I can remember.
Yes.
He's never out there going after independents. He's never out there going after disaffected Democrats. Mm-hmm. It's all about the base.
Exactly. And Tester is doing the smart thing. He's talking about his accomplishments. Don't make your reelection campaign, regardless of what level it is, don't make it about Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. Make it about the policies. That's what people want to hear.
That's right. 30 seconds left. We talked last week about the idea of a blue wave, and that pundits are saying that in order for there to be a blue wave in the House of Representatives, the Democrats are going to have to win the generic vote. That is, would you prefer a Democrat in the House or a Republican in the House, by between 9 and 12 percentage points. So the latest polls, all current to this week, according to Politico, have the Democrats by 4, Democrats by 6, Democrats by 10, Democrats by 10, by 9, by 8, and by 9. So this really is going to be one heck of a race that goes right down to the very end. Mm-hmm. And certainly bears watching. And I'm not talking about just individual House races here and there. I mean nationwide. Anything could happen in November.
Yes. I mean, branding is important for both parties. And week by week, it just seems that the GOP's branding is pretty indefensible.
This is going to be tough for them. This could be one of those watershed elections.
I think so.
I think it very well could be. Well, we're going to leave it there. We were joined here in the studio by Jacqueline Lukman. She's the co-editor-in-chief of Lukman Nation, and you can check out her live stream every Thursday night at 9 p.m. on Facebook. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.